when it happened and where they happened. Stories that just pack a punch, that have a message. The church isn't remembering everything that Jesus did. The church, remember, we got to always come back to it, is that group that is experiencing the Spirit of Jesus. We know He lives. Now, we want to preserve memories that help us understand Jesus who's touching us. Not everything that Jesus did and said could be remembered. Not everything that Jesus did and said should be remembered. You know, He may have said, pass the salt. That's not worth remembering because the food wasn't salty enough. He may have had fish one day for lunch and, you know, lamb the next. That's not worth remembering. The church remembered what helped individuals understand Jesus better and respond to Him. The actions of Jesus that would show new insight into His Lordship. Jesus healing. Jesus walking around eating a meal with the prostitutes and the mafia of His day to show that Jesus never will break His friendship with us. So this helps us understand something about Jesus touching us. Words of Jesus that would give a new insight into His Lordship or into how we should respond. These are remembered too. So these are the kind of things, you know, a new commandment I give you, a new guide for living. Love one another the way I'm loving you. These are the things that are remembered, what Jesus did and what Jesus says, that help us understand what Jesus is doing and how we can respond to Him now. So, if you start with this first, if you took the whole life of Jesus, there's no interest at all until Jesus actually starts saving people. And if you go to the first gospel, the Gospel of Mark, you hear this is the good news of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. And then you hear about John the Baptizer as an adult baptizing, and within 10 verses, Jesus appears to be baptized. Nothing about where Jesus was born, nothing about what He did as a kid, nothing about, you know, how, where He went to apply for His first Social Security card, none of that stuff. You hear the moment when Jesus is publicly anointed with the Spirit to start saving us. That's what is important, because what's important now? Jesus saving me. Now, how am I going to understand Jesus saving me? Not by looking at what He did as a kid in Nazareth or as an adult in Nazareth before He began saving. If I look at what He did when He actually went forth from Nazareth to start saving people, that'll help me understand what He's doing as He enters my life right now. That's one of the best indications. I can look at what He did to understand what He is doing. So Jesus is experienced in the church as saving the church. So all they're interested in are those actions of Jesus in which He went forth to save the world, and that's the public ministry of Jesus. And the first gospel has nothing at all to say about what happened before that. Matthew and Luke will give us a few little insights into the child, the infancy of Jesus, to help us understand Jesus as Lord today. And John goes before that to the pre-existence of Jesus. So in retelling, the stories tend to lose everything that's unimportant and to take a standard form. The stories are smoothed out. For example, just to show you what I mean by this, miracles. An eyewitness would give you the whole account. Hey, we were walking down the street. Jesus was talking to us. There was this problem that we were discussing. And all of a sudden, we heard this voice shout. No, it was just terrible. We ignored it. You know, there was a smell and everything else in the area. It was pretty. You wouldn't want to go there. And then this guy starts shouting louder and louder, Son of David, have mercy on us. Well, we didn't want to disturb Jesus because what he was telling us was really interesting. So we just, you know, sent somebody over to hush him, and he started yelling all the louder, Son of David, have mercy on us. And darned if Jesus didn't stop and go over to see what was going on. And he healed the cat. Well, that would be how an eyewitness would tell it. But it isn't the way it's told publicly. You're going to tell a story about a miracle. What do you need? You've got to know that somebody's sick. So you present the sick person. Then the sick person has to take his need and present it to Jesus. So the sick person contacts Jesus. Then Jesus responds to the sick person, yet not the healing. Okay, you know, I'm going to do it somehow. Your faith is going to save you. Then Jesus works the miracle. Now, even back then, people wondered about mob psychology. So you got to prove that it's a miracle. Show that the crowd all goes, ooh, look at what Jesus did. So you got to prove it's been a miracle. And that's the form that miracles standardly take. Especially in the Gospel of Matthew. I told you, Matthew writes 20 years after Mark, and he's pretty dull. Matthew has one part of his Gospel. We'll, if we have time, share a little bit about this, where he gives you 10 miracles in a row. And you almost get bored. You hear the person, you hear the person's need, the need's presented to Jesus, Jesus responds, Jesus works the miracle, and the crowd responds. The crowd's amazed. Scene 2. You meet the person presents his need, Jesus responds to the need, the miracle is worked, the crowd responds. Scene 3, you meet the person presents his need. Now, occasionally, it'll be shaved down more, but this is the standard form. So that's what happens in retelling. It's the easiest way to remember it all. It's the most natural way to tell a miracle. An eyewitness, they don't happen that way. An eyewitness will give it to you in a much different form. So the stories take on a very standard form. And there are certain kinds of stories that are remembered. Miracles. Controversies. I won't go through them all. So that's one whole type. All the miracles of Jesus. That might be all these. And then the controversies, when he had sort of arguments or debates with the Pharisees. Those stories are remembered, and they're told in a pretty standard way. Stories that are kind of built around some saying. Where Jesus says, look, you got to become a little child if you want to become part of the kingship. So they remember a time when the parents wanted to bring their kids to Jesus. The disciples said no, and Jesus tells the disciples, you're doing it wrong. Let the children come to me, for if such is the kingship of God. And the story is remembered because of the saying, and there's other things like this. So there's loads of little stories, and then some that are just all by themselves. Unique to themselves, that are passed down and remembered in the church because they have some meaning for the church of this time. Was important for the, incidentally, the stories about, I'll just give you a good example. The story, we'll bring it up another time. The story about the bringing the children to Jesus is probably a story handling a debate that exists today in 1977, and it existed in the Church of Jesus. Do you baptize children or don't you? Do you baptize babies? Some people didn't want to baptize babies. Parents were bringing their babies to the church for baptism. Some of the disciples were saying, no, don't do that. You don't baptize kids. They're not ready yet. So the disciples are shown rebuking the parents. Not because Jesus is tired. They don't want the parents to bring their kids, so they're rebuking the parents. This is a baptism story. And Jesus tells the disciples, hey, don't do that. Let these children come to me. For if such is the kingship. So what was the decision of the very earliest church? Not to wait till a person becomes an adult to baptize him. The earliest church took a story of Jesus and handled this problem. The story's remembered not because it's so sweet to hear Jesus cuddling a kid. Uh-uh. These stories aren't remembered that way. They're remembered for what Jesus is doing now. What does Jesus want? Jesus wants to start salvation for children. That means the children themselves should be baptized. And a story of Jesus is remembered because it handled this problem. And in Matthew, not in Mark, in Matthew, Jesus lays his hands upon the children. And that is a technical expression identified with the sacrament of baptism in the early church. The laying of hands. So it's a baptism story handling a problem way back then in all probability. So, stories are remembered this way, because they have meaning. Some of the stories are collected. There's two parables that probably very early are linked. Oh, there's parable stories, too, of Jesus. There's two parables that very early are linked together, because they're so similar. About a merchant who goes in search of a pearl and finds one. His whole life was looking for good pearls, and he finds one that's so great it's worth everything he has, so he sells everything and buys it. There's another one about a man who doesn't go searching. He stumbles on a treasure in a field, and it's so great he sells everything he has to buy the field so he can have the treasure. Well, they're pretty similar. So those stories are linked and they're remembered together. Somebody told one and somebody else was scratching. You know, that sounds like something else, Jesus says. I remember one, it's like jokes, where sometimes you get jokes together. The one brought up the other, they were put together and they're told together. In the Gospel of Mark, there's four stories in a row with Jesus having debates with the Pharisees. And some scholars feel that these stories were linked together before Mark. They were just told one after another. So there's little collections made where stories are told in a row, and there's one very important collection made. You have all isolated stories except for the Passion. Very, very early, the Passion is told as one big continuous story. Because this was the biggest stumbling block that the church had to face. The church was sending people out to announce the good news that the Lord became Jesus to be the Christ. Now, the word Christ means Messiah. Jesus is saving. He's this Jewish Messiah. And the Jews crucified him. That's the most shameful form of death. Now, how are you going to handle the fact that he who was sent to save couldn't even save himself from the most shameful of all deaths? Therefore, the church had to get its story straight. And the events of the death of Jesus are not a series of isolated stories. When you look at these, they show that from the earliest days they are told pretty much together. Now, there are different tellings. John's tradition of the Passion is a little bit different from Mark's, and Mark's is a little bit different from Luke's. Mark and Matthew are very close together. But all three of them don't have a lot of separate stories brought together. They originally were that, but very, very early, the Passion is brought together as one large story. So what you have then, for the first 40 years before Mark starts writing, you have a collection of gospel stories, of the Passion. There was another possible collection of sayings of Jesus, just isolated sayings. Not with stories built around them. The kind that go into the sermons of Matthew. So a collection just of all the sayings of Jesus, and then these isolated stories with no time and no place. Now, nobody can go in and pull from one of these stories the details to say which one happens before or after. Okay. First point is the gospel is Jesus. Second point, then, in the early church, stories of what Jesus did are remembered to help us understand what Jesus is doing. But these stories are remembered without the details that would be necessary to write a life of Jesus. As they're retold, where and when is dropped. And all we're left with is the story itself in a smooth form. And you just can't go back and figure out where and when. Today, they could have back then, but they didn't care about that. See, if you go back to something I shared with you, maybe you'll understand a little bit why there's this very interesting gap, why nobody wrote a life of Jesus. Remember that Paul wrote to the Thessalonians 20 years after the resurrection, telling them that they better work because Jesus may not just come back to tonight, and you got to be mature. But still, at the time Paul's writing to the Thessalonians, most Christians are expecting Jesus to come back next weekend. And if Jesus is going to come back in end time next weekend, well, why write a life? Who's going to read it? So nobody wrote a life of Jesus. It was useless because there'd be nobody to read it. It's very, very different from writing a first gospel. So, going on then, all Christians' gospel, we've mentioned that before, all of them, and we're all supposed to continue gospeling. Jesus has called you to be filled with his Spirit, to experience the very life force of Jesus, to know that you are loved with the love of God, to know that you live with the holiness of God, to know that you breathe with the goodness of God because Jesus is yours and his spirit life being is yours. So that excited by what Jesus is doing for you, you go and tell it to someone else who doesn't feel very good about where they're at, who feels insecure about their being. You're going to want to turn them on the way Jesus is turning you on. You're going to want Jesus to turn them on. So you go and announce it to them. People don't do it in writing. They did it by living differently. Through history, from the earliest days, a line has come down. Look at these Christians. My, how they love one another. They stood out as being very, very different in the Roman Empire. They lived differently. They lived the Spirit of Jesus. They were people who could walk into an arena where they were going to be killed, smiling and blessing their persecutors. Roman barbarian soldiers who were about the crudest possible people to be imagined, who treated them like dirt, and who were converted, many of them, because there was just something different about these Christians. They gospeled by living, and they gospeled by talking. They didn't have anything in writing for 40 years. As I shared with you, each shared Jesus differently because each one experienced Jesus differently and because each of them had their own personality. By my understanding, Matthew was a dull man, and I don't think I'd enjoy spending a week in a cabin with Matthew. Mark, I would. John, well, maybe. If you like deep intellectual conversations, you'd like to spend a week in a cabin with John. Now, they're all experiencing a Jesus who's exciting. But no matter how exciting Jesus is, Matthew himself, by my understanding, is a pretty dull man. And Jesus loves people who, by my opinion, are dull. And he uses everyone, because nobody dull in God's eyes. They're all beautiful. It's just that I've got different values from God. Jesus was too rich for anyone to capture completely. An example of this today is Father Levin and I experience Jesus differently, and we share Jesus differently. And we definitely have some different understandings. Father Levin just gets, he still can't understand my basic theology. My whole theology is, no matter what your problem is, let Jesus love you. No matter what's going on, no matter where you're at, no matter what difficulty you're facing spiritually, the answer is going to church and let Jesus love you more. And that's the answer. And it just blows some people's minds because, you know, we were raised with the doing, 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 doing. What should I do? Let Jesus love you. That's what you ought to do. The rest happens, incidentally. I don't mean that you let Jesus love you and then you sit down. You know, I can't say I got a class tonight, so I'll go and let Jesus love me and then let Jesus teach it. I go, I've got to let Jesus love me or I have nothing to offer you. When I get nervous, I got to let Jesus love me. But I also then have to do some work. And if I let Jesus love me enough, I'll be at peace to experience him, to put it down on paper, and to share it with you. But the answer to any problem is that, by my understanding, is let Jesus love me. Now, Father Levin can't experience him this way, so we share him slightly differently. Our personalities are different. He doesn't talk as much as I do, so his sermons are shorter. They are. His sermons are a little shorter. The longest I've gone, well, it was the other night here, 2.5 hours with another 45-minute repeat, and I wasn't talked out. My feet were a little sore, but I could have gone another 2 hours. I have never been talked out in my life that I'm aware of, but I've got to put sort of a governor on my mouth and keep it down. Anyway, so we're different. We share Jesus different, and the same thing with the early church. Each offers Jesus as they experience him. Each offers Jesus as he's touching them in their heart with his spirit. They're not offering ideas. They're gospeling the reality of Jesus in their life, the living Jesus in their lives. And as they do this, they do it according to their personality. Now, for these people, get rid of this part now. Keep that. That's going to be very important. We have the passion and the collection of sayings. But I've got to put the collection of sayings down on the bottom of the board because Mark doesn't know about it, probably. Just Matthew and Luke. Four people, Matthew, Mark, this isn't the order, they're in the New Testament, is almost definitely wrong. I'll give you the dates now, roughly. Mark Matthew and Luke, you can't really tell a good before and after. Most people would put Matthew a little earlier. They write probably before the year 90, anywhere from about 75 to 90. And then John writes somewhere around the year 100. Except that, I can tell you, I'll get to that later. I don't want to upset you. That would be a very bad way to do it. Now, these four are not the only people who put an experience of Jesus in writing. There is the gospel according to Thomas. There's the gospel according to Peter. There's the gospel according to Jude. These other gospels never made it into the Bible. And that's very crucial. The church read them and could not accept them. No church ever did. The fact that the living, now the church is the living people of God. It's not some group of bishops or anybody. It's the whole people of God. The fact that the people of God accept these four means that what these four communicate about Jesus first is acceptable to the Spirit of Jesus as experienced in the church. So it's the living Jesus in the church that first is most important, that kept the stories alive that these people will use. And it's the Spirit of the Jesus alive in the church that is the standard first to make sure that these four come into the Bible. When they're in the Bible, then, they now become a standard by which the church can always measure itself to make sure it's not drifting from what Jesus should be. These others, Pete, Jude, they're not written by Pete and Jude. They're written by people who say that they're Pete and Jude, but they ain't. They never make it in the Bible. These four, therefore, guarantee two very important things. The fact the church accepts them guarantees you that it is Jesus, it is really the Spirit of the living Jesus that is being experienced. Matthew isn't confusing what he wants Jesus to be with what Jesus is. Over in these Gospels, you get a lot of that. Jesus will be petty as a child. He's playing with somebody, and the person gets him mad, so he strikes him dead. And then he feels sorry, so he brings him back to life. Well, that is not the Jesus of the church. The man who wrote that didn't really experience Jesus. He confused his experience with what he would want to do. He'd want to strike out and get vengeance on his enemies and would have Jesus doing that, so he's not open enough. So the fact that these four come in tell us, listen, it is really Jesus who lives. Jesus in the glory with his Father, it is this Jesus who is really being experienced by each of these people. And secondly, it isn't just enough to experience it. I can have a correct experience, but be wrong in the way I present it. Last night I did that at a meeting that I was at. I was chairing the meeting and I gave my own impression on something that was very, very important. And we went around the table speaking and there was somebody brand new, very, very new, who spoke. And when he got through, I realized that I had given everybody a wrong impression. That he and I, it would seem, were saying opposite things when we were saying the same, and I had to correct what I said and show how what I said was very much the same as what he said. Well, the fact the church accepts these four guarantees not only that they experience Jesus correctly, but that what they write is an accurate sharing of the Spirit of the living Jesus. So there is something very, very special about these four and their gospeling. Carries this double guarantee, which is crucial for us. One side effect of what I've just shared, now I can go back and tell you what I was just wanted to tell you a moment ago, and I forgot where I put it in. The fact that the Spirit of Jesus guarantees this work, protected these people, touched them so strongly that it's really him and made sure that they didn't confuse Jesus with someone else, also protects them in communicating so that they don't get foggy and distort what he really is doing. This makes it absolutely unimportant who these people were. And I can now tell you that scholars will say Matthew did not write Matthew. Either John didn't write the finished gospel. And whoever wrote the gospel didn't write the book of Apocalypse, and probably did not write the three letters of John. They're from the same school, but by different people. It is quite possible, half the scholars will say Luke didn't write Luke, and well, they just don't know who wrote Mark. You see, the Spirit of Jesus writes them all. Now, we're very sure that Matthew did not write Matthew, the person that we believe to be Matthew. None of the Gospels, the finished Gospels, are written by an eyewitness, someone who really walked with Jesus the whole time. All of them are written by a heart witness, if I could coin that word, by someone whom in their heart is experiencing Jesus in his glory is really, is Peter, much more really than Peter did when Peter was walking with Jesus, because Peter still didn't have the full vision of faith to understand with whom he was walking. He didn't know Jesus was God till the resurrection. The person who writes this gospel does. The Spirit guarantees that the works are accurate, so it doesn't make any difference who really wrote. Probably Mark wrote Mark because there wasn't anybody important in the early church. And why call a gospel according to Mark? You know, why pick a nobody and say he wrote a gospel? Luke, they reached Luke from evidence in his works, but though that evidence is pretty doubtful, so they kind of challenged that. So in case you hear somebody say, well, listen, Matthew didn't write Matthew, doesn't make any difference. The fact the church accepted that gospel guarantees the only authorship that's important. The church is saying this is Jesus. Whoever wrote it is experiencing Jesus and is communicating Jesus. Therefore, this gospel is an instrument of Jesus to help us and every Christian who will pick it up and read it in an open way to experience Jesus himself. That's not that important, but just so your faith will never be shaken, I just throw it in. Going on, four people, so summarizing, going back, and I do want to do this, the gospel is a person. The stories that the church remembered about this person make it impossible to write his life, but the stories are remembered to help us understand this person as he lives, and as he lives to save us now. Four individuals, each in their own different way, experienced Jesus. Just to give you a quick breakdown, so you'll understand what I mean, they all experienced Jesus differently. Luke experiences a Jesus who has the greatest concern for the cast-offs of the world. Women, they were nobody in the society of his time. Luke constantly points out, more than anybody by far, how women are with Jesus. Luke is the greatest in showing Jesus with all the other cast-offs. The most attention to Jesus traveling with the prostitutes and the sinners, the good Samaritans, the Samaritans were hateful. So Luke really has a Jesus who really solidly cares for the nobodies and who is absolutely universal. We'll see that in a little more deeply. Mark experiences a Jesus who is known most in his dying. Mark's gospel is a passion with an introduction. And it's very, you got to zero in upon Jesus dying. So Jesus is ever so human because he must die. Matthew's Jesus is Lord of history, and Matthew shaves away all of the human characteristics that he finds in Mark. He doesn't want Jesus to get flustered and frustrated. He forgets those events because Matthew knows the Jesus whom he's experiencing is not only his Christ, but he's Lord of history. And as Lord of history, he doesn't get flustered or frustrated. He's above it all. The Jesus whom John experiences is a very deep, total person who is everything. So therefore, in himself, he's revising anything that people had before. He takes everything that the Jewish faith has, and he replaces it with himself. He's the good shepherd, so he's the leaders of Israel. He is the Sabbath rest. Come unto me. Well, that's not in Matthew, but he is the Sabbath rest. He is the only form of purification. He is the new Paschal Lamb. He is the new temple. Jesus is all of this, as John experiences him. So that would be a quick way to look at just the vaguest or the overall details of the differences of Jesus as presented by each of these four. Each of the four are trying to share the Jesus they experience, the living Jesus alive in them. None of the four are trying to give us a life of Christ. The good news is not a life of Christ, but the living Christ. It is not a life of Jesus, but the living Jesus. Probably the last serious effort in the Catholic Church to write a life of Jesus, it was done by a cardinal, was published around the year 1958. Serious Protestant scholars would have said it was impossible at least 25 years before that. If somebody is writing a life of Jesus, be very, very suspect. You simply can't take it. It'd be like you're remembering everything you can from the last 3 years of hearing the gospel read on Sundays. All these isolated stories and trying to put them together and tell which one happened before and where they happened and which ones happened after. You can't. And that's exactly how the stories were remembered. Well, gospels are read to bring out particular points. The stories were remembered for particular points without before and after. It's crucial that you remember this when you pick up the gospels to read. Because if you're reading to learn something about the life of Jesus, you're most likely to miss the living Jesus. If you understand that there's not an effort being made to tell you much about the life of Jesus, all they're concerned about is looking at what Jesus did to help you understand what Jesus is doing for you at this moment, then you're going to be open to experience the living Jesus now. Mark is not interested in telling you what Jesus...